and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We have four bills up today, and we will be going in the order that we have them listed, mainly because people are in other committees testifying on other things, and we have our panel here this morning on House Bill 2389. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2389 and ask the staff to give us the summary of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2389 establishes a notice of condition procedure for recovering damage for residential construction defects prior to initiating arbitration or commencing court action against the contractor, subcontractor, or supplier.
Thank you, Megan. I'd like to call up a panel, Scott Berry, Dan Dorn, Paul Gary of OBIA, Ron Manza, professional insurance agents. We have enough chairs for everybody. Yes, we do.
Good morning, Chair Close and the members of the committee. We are here this morning to promote and talk about House Bill 2389. It's a culmination of a lot of work within our industry to try to address the issue of skyrocketing insurance premiums for our folks. And like a lot of bills, it comes into the process with what we think is a good set of principles, but like many things, it needs some work, and we do have some amendments we'll be bringing forward to you at the next hearing on this bill. And I just want to talk a little bit about that. We are working with the Oregon Trial Lawyers and the Construction Contractors Board, both of whom had a couple of concerns that we should have no problem working those out. And we'll provide just one set of amendments for the final bill. In addition to that, though, I did want to mention currently the landscape architects would be considered a part of this bill. We would like to remove them, and those amendments will take care of that as well. Having said that, I'd just like to introduce the folks that we brought up here. Dan Dorn with Sunset Homes, a builder with Oregon Building Industry Association. He's been a member for a number of years and a former past president of our association. Paul Gary is an attorney from the Portland area, who's also a member and someone we've been working with closely to help draft this legislation. And Ron Manza is with the professional insurance agents. And again, we've been working with the insurance industry as well to help draft this piece of legislation. So.
Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Without further ado, I'll introduce Dan Dorn and let him talk a little bit about the issue and how we got here and where we'd like to go.
Thanks, Scott. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning on this issue. Item of correction, I'm with Sunco Homes and Remodeling, not Sunset Homes. Sunset is what's going to happen to my business if we don't solve this insurance crisis. And what we're talking to you about today is only one piece of a puzzle that will help create a cure for us. And it's frustrating as a building contractor to be in the position and the situation that we're faced with today. I've been a building contractor here in Salem for 25 years, and I build homes and remodel homes, and we do a little bit of commercial business. And I'm going to talk to you about my personal problem with insurance and when I conclude this. But right now, the crisis with insurance is in the contractor's arena is the ability or the inability for us to purchase insurance. And if we can purchase insurance, the cost has skyrocketed. And we're talking about not a little change. The smallest changes that I have seen to date are in the 50% range. And that was in the first go-around once the crisis hit. And in the first go-around, when I refer to that, was 2 years ago in 2001, the contractors that were renewing their insurance at that period, at that time with certain companies, companies that were getting out of the general liability market, and that put these contractors out looking for insurance on the open market, and they were looking at 50 to 100% increases in their premiums. Today we have reports of companies that are faced with 900% increases in insurance costs. Now, the crisis in this case, I think it's real for the insurance industry. And the reason that we have the crisis, and I don't want to bore you with this too much, but the stock market has not been performing, and that's where the industry, as I understand it, was deriving a lot of their income. And then September 11th, that day represented the highest loss in insurance history in the world. And then for contractors, it's further exasperated because of our construction defects claims and problems that we are having with products that the industry has actually the changing times and the economics of building houses has caused companies to go out and try to find new products to preserve wood and that'll have a positive economic and environmental impact. And some of these products have not performed like they should perform, and it has caused construction defects in some cases that are real and in some cases that are not as real. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of companies and people that I know and I work with and the problems that they're experiencing. My framing contractor, and this has an impact on the cost of the houses and the products that I build. My framing contractor has had four different carriers in 2 years, and I think that math works out. I'm sure he told me four different carriers, but 2 years ago, his insurance premium was $7,500 a year. He did approximately $2 to $3 million in business a year. In the subsequent years, and that was in 2000-2001, in 2001-2002, his premium went to $9,600. He had to get a new carrier because the carrier he was with quit writing insurance in the contractor's general liability arena. The next year, it went to $21,000. And this year, he just signed a policy that costs him $32,000 a year. Approximately 40% of his business has been multifamily housing units, and his new policy will not allow him to build a multifamily unit that includes more than four units in a single building. So that's taken 40% of his business and just wiped it off the slates. Other contractors I've talked to, and I need to also say that this particular contractor has a favorable loss ratio, and he hasn't had great losses or any substantial losses in the last 2 or 3 years either, and still he's faced with this type of impact. Other contractors that I know that are responsible individuals, they're fiscally responsible, and they build very, very good products, have had some problems with EIFS is one of the problems that they faced, and they are now forced with the decision of closing their businesses because of the EIFS claims that are coming against them, and they have to make a decision whether they're going to continue to operate and lose all of their assets or close their businesses and start anew. And I don't see that as a very responsible thing to do, although they really have no other choice. What I mean by responsible is it is not good for the clients or the contractors that are involved in these situations.
Mr. Dern, could you tell us what EIFS claims are?
EIFS is a synthetic stucco that was produced a few years. No, it's been on the market for over 10 years. It was the end-all of all items for siding products. It was impervious to water, but what happened was it trapped moisture inside buildings, and if not properly installed, buildings began to rot from the inside out.
Madam Chair, may I please.
Representative Shoffley.
Thank you. And the framer is getting sued because of this problem, even though he did not apply this siding, correct?
That is correct. Right now, on a construction defect claim, every contractor that's been on the project is being named and sued. And that includes the landscape contractor, the roofing contractor, along with the siding contractors and suppliers. The company that supplies the windows to the job site and has nothing to do with the manufacture of those windows or the installation of those windows is also named in these suits. So you can probably just guess, I probably don't have to talk to you about the economic impacts of this insurance crisis as it refers to housing. And home ownership in America has always been considered the American dream. And right now we are enjoying the highest home ownership rates in the country in history at 67% of all families in America today own their own houses. This will have a negative impact on that. But here at home, we don't enjoy those numbers. We don't enjoy the home ownership rate that we see nationally. We are a full 10% under the national rate already. And with this impact of insurance costs and litigation and companies going out of business and therefore reducing the choices that the families have, well, it is a very negative impact to the housing and housing affordability, which I think is an important piece of this whole puzzle. I think I've probably taken enough of your time today. In conclusion, there is one other thing. This is kind of a silent killer among building contractors, and I told you that I would conclude by telling you how it's affecting me as a contractor. I'm not 100% sure how it's affecting me right now. I know that my rates have gone up 50% each year the last 2 years for my insurance. But the insurance carrier I'm with is no longer going to write general liability insurance, and they stopped doing that just about 11 months ago. So I'm in the last group of contractors that are going to be impacted by this, which is difficult because over the last 2 or 3 years, contractors have been affected differently, and therefore we compete differently. And I have maybe enjoyed a economic advantage over my fellow contractors the last 2 years, and I've been able to price my product without having the effects of this insurance. Some contractors have equated the insurance cost to up the cost of their houses by $2,000 per home. My insurance expires on April 15th of this year, and at that time, I really don't know what it is that I'm going to be faced with for costs at this time. And it's a minefield for me because I have contracts that we've recently signed and projects that are just coming out of the ground right now that I'm going to have to live with for the next 6 to 8 months. And I'm negotiating contracts currently. There again, I'm doing this kind of in the dark because I really don't know what the fiscal impact of my insurance costs are going to be after April 15th. Another reason that this is a silent killer is if you drive downtown and JCPenney's or Nordstrom goes out of business, you see the effects of that, and you see the window coverings go up and the doors boarded up, and everybody says, oh my gosh, this is a terrible problem. When a building contractor or the construction industry is going out of business, the public doesn't see this because we leave beautiful projects out there and we leave homes and neighborhoods. And people look at the homes and neighborhoods and they think, oh, that was a successful project. But in reality, somewhere in a back office of somebody's house, there might not be any activity going on anymore. And the construction industry, residential construction, represents 5 cents of every dollar of the gross national product. I don't know how that equates here in Salem and around Oregon, but I know it has to be somewhere similar and close to that. So I just ask the committee to look closely at this and try to help the state of Oregon and home ownership in the state and help fill this one piece of this large puzzle that we have to work with and close the gap. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Gregg.
Dan, just one quick question. According to the bill, after the contractor's been notified of a defect by the owner, you have... The contractor would then have 90 days to respond to the owner with either we'll compensate you or whatever. Is that 90-day period, and I would assume insurance companies would be required to have the liability here, does that 90 days give the contractor time enough to have the insurance company respond before he or she would respond to the owner?
I think it gives the contractor enough time to do the research and talk to the insurance company, if this is the answer to your question, to actually make the cure that's required might not be as practical and may not be able to occur in the 90 days. But I would think 90 days would be enough time to identify what the problem is and determine what the cure would be and if the cure can be performed. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, member of the committees, good morning. I'm Ron Manza. I'm representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon and Idaho this morning. I hold the Certified Property and Casualty Insurance designation. The Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon is a trade association of independents throughout the state who represent a wide variety of insurance companies and serve both individual homeowners and contractors alike. We see HB 2389 as a process of communication that will benefit both the homeowner and the contracting community. The agents have watched the insurance market change dramatically, primarily in the last couple of years. Standard carriers have withdrawn from the construction market, and the void has been filled with a relatively small number of specialty companies who, of course, have got higher premiums and constricted coverage in a lot of cases. Because of the constriction in the market, the PIA board was concerned and formed a task force, of which I am the chair. The members were made up primarily of agents that had some construction experience and also insurance company representatives in the area, the majority of which have exited the market but were concerned because they had to do that. Those decisions were normally made out of state, and it's always been one of the pride and joys of the local community to take care of contractors. The task force has considered the issue. We believe this is a bill that is a positive step to stabilize costs. It will also show insurance carriers that Oregon is proactive in construction litigation. That is becoming more important. They are looking. There are a lot of people that want to know what goes on here this morning. And we also have many bills in other states surrounding us that have been already approved or in that process. So the industry is watching. The professional insurance agents strongly urge you to pass HB 2389. I'd be happy to answer any insurance questions you may have. Thank you.
I have a question.
Representative Shoffley.
And I don't know if it's to the insurance person or not, but now, this bill in no way will remove coverage of a homeowner or remove the ability of a homeowner to sue due to negligence, incompetence, or defective material. That individual, homeowners like us, will still be allowed to sue for those things, but not just everybody that's on the job site. Very specific.
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffer, that's correct. We're not taking anything away. We're actually adding a process, which is important, not from the contractor's side as much, to a certain extent, from the homeowner's side, because the homeowners today do not have any direction other than from agents like myself. They don't know what to do. These claims don't always include an insurance company. Usually in one form or another they do, but the homeowners don't have the wherewithal, and where do we start? Who do we talk to? Where do we go? Where do we get testing done if testing needs to be done? How do we turn it? How do we start this whole process? And by putting it in writing, we basically now have something to say, okay, this is what you have to do. This is who you have to see. And then they will have to respond to you. So it kind of opens up this communication for responsible people to take care of whatever has to be done in a nice formal manner.
Representative Kitts.
I got a several part question. It appears that currently that the contractors offer, according to this, a free dispute resolution service if a claim has been filed currently. Is that my understanding that correctly? Is that a yes?
I could not answer that. You'd have to ask the construction industry.
I'm just reading from the bill summary.
Can you repeat the question, please?
I can. It says that currently there is a procedure in place for the construction contractors board offers a free dispute resolution if a claim has been filed.
That's correct. Chair Close, Representative Kitts, that's a claim filed with the construction contractors board. Usually those will be required to be filed during the first year of construction. This process is really outside of that, and it's designed to take care of getting the homeowner and the builder together from year two, after the construction contractors board process is no longer available, to year 10, which is the end of the liability on the builder.
Sure. Now, follow-up, please. If there are no claims, I have landscape contractors insurance and have carried it for 2 years now. My rates have not gone up in 2 years. I've never had a claim. Knock on wood. Are you saying that your claims are going up? And I think that the CCB versus the LCB, you guys probably take on more liability than we do with the nature of your job. Are your rates going up without claims? Are you having claims? Is that why your rates are going up? Or are your rates just simply going up to go up?
Our rates are going up without claims. My rate took a 50% increase in 2001-2002 with never having a claim filed.
Okay. Follow up.
Okay.
My only concern in reading this right now is that if, in fact, the option is to go back in and fix the problem, to me it's almost like, if I get caught shoplifting, I then agree to pay for it. Is that not a fair analogy to make?
I don't believe that that's fair. And the reason I don't believe that's fair is this isn't a willful intent to build a defective product. It's products that have failed in some cases that passed all their testing before they came onto the market. And they're sold to building contractors as, you know, the latest and greatest product, and everybody wants it. And in a lot of cases, especially with EIFs, clients have been almost demanding EIFs. And even since the problems have occurred, in 2001, in June of 2001, I knew the problems of EIFs, and I had a client that almost walked away from a project because I would not install the product. So that's part of the problem. Then, as these things come up, it isn't a willful. If you go in to steal a candy bar, you know you're doing it, and you put it in your pocket, and everyone knows that that's wrong. Or I believe they know it's wrong. With what's happening in the construction industry, we don't always know what's wrong. Also, with the construction contractor resolution process, once a lawsuit's filed, the construction contractor's resolution process or ability for that process goes away. It ends at that time.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, gentlemen. I had a couple of questions, and my first one relates to what Representative Garrard asked you, and I know most contractors are responsible and trying to do a good job, but in every profession, there always are bad apples. And my concern is, what if you have somebody that, you know, is performing slipshod work and the homeowner wants to get the problem fixed but hasn't gotten satisfaction? I'm asking specifically about the 90-day period in which the contractor has to just respond to that initial letter. 3 months seems like a long time to me if you're waiting to have something in your house made right or have recourse to go somewhere else. Is it really necessary for it to be a three-month period? That's not for the work. It's just for responding to that initial letter.
If I may, Paul Gary, I think what we see here is, if I may back up for 1 second in answering your question, is a hopefully a replacement to litigation as a first option for an impasse between a homeowner and a builder. But certain components of what you see in litigation have to be addressed here. And among those components is, from the standpoint of the builder, the ability to get others involved. Others might be a product manufacturer, might be a subcontractor, and getting notice out to others and getting those entities involved so that you can have a coordinated response to a homeowner, in our view, is what pushed it out to the 90 days. So that within that time, all the entities that may be responsible are on notice, have had an opportunity to come in and do an inspection, and then get a response to the homeowner in the form, hopefully, of an offer to repair.
Follow up. But it looks to me like, reading Section 3 of the bill, you only have 14 days to decide if there are subcontractors or other entities that you want to serve notice on to make them responsible for this complaint, too. Is that right?
Correct.
So then, why would you need the full 90 days beyond that first 2 weeks when you've made that decision?
Well, the 90 days is after the initial notice is received by the builder. And within that period of time, we'd have all responsible parties notified and then an opportunity to inspect. And normally it takes some time to get people involved and the right people involved to do an inspection. These are really largely physical evidence cases, and people need to get in, and competent people need to be able to come and look at a situation, identify what the problem may be with the home, essentially time to allocate among themselves what responsibility is, and then make a coordinated offer to a homeowner. I believe 90 days is going to go by real quick, and to the extent if this was to become law, I'd certainly be advising my clients, be prepared to act and act quickly when these notices come in, because the 3 months is going to go by in a hurry.
And one more question, Madam Chair. I guess this is a two-part question. First, the homeowner has to list every defect they're complaining of. Is that list going to prevent them from, if they do eventually have to go to court, complaining of other defects that they might not have been aware of initially? That's the first part of the question. The second part is, how does the time limits that are imposed on court action, how does that compare with the current statute of limitations on somebody who just goes to court without going through this process?
Well, you're going to have to repeat for me your first question, if you would.
My first question is, the letter that the homeowner initially writes to start this process says that it has to specify a description of each defect being complained of and the remedial action the owner believes is necessary and incidental damages. So what I'm asking is, suppose I, as a homeowner, you know, I don't know anything about construction. I don't know technically what all may be entailed in fixing what's wrong, and there may be problems that weren't apparent to me when I first looked at my bathroom or whatever. Will that, what I put down in that letter, prevent me later from being able to go to court and complain about things that I didn't list out there because I wasn't aware of them or didn't describe them correctly?
Not if you were focusing on that area of the home. If you had a problem with your bathroom, you didn't describe it with any great particularity, but you've advised the builder, I've got a problem in the area of the bathroom of my home. That claim would move forward and allow you to go to court. If later you discovered and felt that you had a problem with your deck, which appeared a year later, well, this bill would contemplate that you'd follow this process for that claim about your deck. So that if you have a single claim and it walks through this process, you can go to court on that claim. It's not anticipated that you'd be able to, when you go to court, bring in separate elements that had not gone through this pre-litigation process.
Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum, it is not our intent to, let's say, have a homeowner file or move forward with this process and claim that they've got a concern about their shower leaking into the foundation and after the inspection, so they lift the shower, let's say, and then they find out later it's the sink instead of the shower. That would not keep them from being able to get repairs on the sink and the shower. Does that answer your question? And we're working that stuff out with the trial lawyers to make sure that we're not limiting somebody's rights to by suggesting they would have to name everything in a particular construction defect. And then on the second piece of your question, I believe the bill, in fact, I know the bill actually tolls the statute so that no one is losing time from this process, and your statute of limitations will not run out while you're in this process, if that answers your second question.
Thank you.
Mr. Manzer, I have a question of you. Can you tell me across the country, do most states have the same 10-year limit like Oregon does?
Madam Chair, you're talking about the statute of limitations, the statute of repose. It differs from state to state, and usually it's in the 8, 9, and 10 area, depending on which state you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Kitts is our last question, then we're going to go.
I would yield to Representative Merkley since I've already asked a question.
Sorry, I didn't see Representative Merkley.
Who's after me?
Thank you. I believe that you all are going to be submitting amendments to this bill, so we'll have those additional amendments to look at.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Representative.
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, that's correct. We will be working with a couple of different groups to draft some amendments, and then, again, we hope to have one set of amendments to submit to the committee that we all have agreed on.
So I have a couple questions that may be answered in the upcoming amendments, and if so, just feel free to tell me that we need to take another look at that down the road and not spend too much time on it at this moment. But one thing I would like to see addressed in those amendments is to make sure that there is the ability for the homeowner to easily know who to send their letter to. The homeowner knows who they bought the house from, and their contract probably says how to correspond with the seller, but they probably may not even know who the general contractor is, and certainly not the subs. So we need to make it easy for the homeowner to utilize this process. A second question I have is in regard to problems that need fixing. Water, of course, anything dealing with water is not something you want to sit around and wait for a 90-day period or 14 days in a 90-day period. Let's say, for example, we have a leaking skylight, and that skylight is leaking onto the floor and affecting the carpet. Perhaps the water is going down into the roof rafters and penetrating the roof rafters. So the homeowner is sitting there really worried about their new home and this leaking skylight and doesn't want to just have a bucket sitting on the carpet. So what happens if they say, no, I've contacted the seller. They've told me it'll be 90 days before they can even propose to me what they're going to do. Hey, I need to fix this thing myself. I'm not going to have a skylight dripping down into my living room. Then how does this unfold? Can they still pursue getting compensation back from the seller, or have they basically abandoned their right for compensation by having to undertake the repair themselves?
If I may, Representative Merkley, the most insurance contracts allow for emergency repairs and any kind of damage to prevent further damage. So there is not an insurance contract that would stop a homeowner or a contractor from doing temporary repairs to stop further damage, because quite frankly, it's not the damage from that initial water that is a problem. What the problems are, from a cost standpoint, are the resulting damages such as the mold. Okay, mm-hmm. And I'd like to address the 90-day item if I could, on the basis that it does sound like a long time, but it doesn't sound like a long time when you have to go out as a homeowner, usually get a contractor to take a look at it because you don't know what your problems are. If there's mold, to hire somebody that comes in with one of their wonderful meters to do bug counts and figure out how many bugs you've got per million. And then to go through all these processes, and you may have to have multiple people involved, and that's what causes the losses on these things to escalate. And what the insurance industry is fighting is that if a lawsuit is brought today, and there are 50 contractors that touch that house, including the landscape contractor, they will all be served. Their insurance carriers will all have to answer the summons or the complaint. They will all have to assign an adjuster. They will all have to hire competent consultants to help them with whatever that expertise is. And they basically, at this point, all get together in a big room and figure out who's going to be responsible for what. When you do that, it multiplies, basically, coming out of California, I think the figures are, it multiplies what was a one amount by three. And it's that multiplier that we're trying to not eliminate, because there's no way to eliminate it, but what we're trying to do is soften it and give a process so that things can get done without having that big multiplier.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation, and I want you to know I think that the committee sees that there is a need here. We don't want to lose our contractors in this state, and we want to keep consumer rights also in mind, so we'll look forward to your amendments. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call Bob Repine, Oregon Housing and Community Services, up, and also Bill Boyd, Construction Contractors Board. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Speak here on behalf of House Bill 2389, and I, without getting too much into the details of much of the discussion you heard earlier, I'm here really to advocate or just remind the committee of the role and responsibilities that I'm charged with by the statutes of Oregon to make sure that Oregon has a reasonable, affordable quantity of housing available in the state. And I think through the testimony that you heard and the issues that I have been following relative to liability insurance, affordable housing starts moving away rapidly. I can demonstrate to you or give you indications that in the last 4 years of our first-time homebuyer program, which we fund approximately 160 to 170 homes every year for first-time homebuyers, but the cost of those homes has escalated at about $5,000 per year over the last 4 years. Wow. On the average. We are starting to see those increases, and I think this bill speaks to the issue of how can we in any way possible keep constraints or some accountability on runaway costs that are not because of the development necessarily, because we have outside parties that are influencing our costs, i.e. insurance companies who are trying to recover either lost revenues or cover investments that were not as profitable as they have been in the past. We're not only seeing this in our first-time homebuyer program, but we also see it in our multifamily. The pool of people who build in the multifamily or single-family arena is starting to diminish. I think you heard Mr. Dorn talk about some of those increases of rate. I, for one, was a builder for 25 years, small builder, and whether or not you could absorb those type of rates if you were building less than 10 houses a year would be a questionable whether or not you'd stay in business. Many of the houses that we finance in the state of Oregon, around the state, you will probably find in the metropolitan area are probably built by larger companies. But when you get into the more rural areas, Klamath areas, Lakeview, LeGrand, it's really the small business contractor who's doing much of the work. And if we price them out, a couple things happen. Obviously, either they absorb the cost and pass it on to the buyer, which then makes the affordability get further out of reach, or they no longer exist, and then there's no inventory of housing for people to buy. So in the spirit of what we're trying to do in the state of Oregon, try to take advantage of affordable housing at all opportunities, I think this bill does help dramatically, could address the issue as to escalating costs, as sometimes we have controls over it, sometimes we don't. I think this is one that we could play a definite role in having some controls on stopping the increase in cost.
Good morning, Representative Close. Or do you want to take questions?
Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll give questions to both of you. Okay.
Good morning, Representative Close, and members of the committee. My name is Bill Boyd. I manage the Claims Resolution Program for the Construction Contractors Board. The Construction Contractors Board regulates contractors and runs a dispute resolution program that provides access to the contractor's bond, which is one of the requirements of every contractor to be in business. That bond is usually about $15,000. While I can't testify directly in support of the bill because the board has not had an opportunity to consider it, I want to draw some parallels between this proposal and a similar proposal that we have in HB 2233, which also asks the legislature to set up a requirement for a 30-day notice before filing a claim with the Construction Contractors Board. I can also tell you that the board is extremely alarmed at the increases that we're seeing in the insurance rates that are being imposed on the construction industry. It's we get horror stories almost every week from contractors, almost every day from contractors that are seeing huge rate increases. With your permission, I will briefly describe our claims program so I can show you how it's parallel to the court system. The court system and the CCB does very much the same thing. We handle about 4,000 to 5,000 claims a year. We hold about 500 hearings a year on those claims. And the hearing part is sort of similar to the trial that occurs in the court system. But we have a system that comes before the hearing, which involves an on-site meeting with the parties and looking at the damages and trying to negotiate a settlement agreement between the parties. And if failing that, our investigator determines what the defects are and what needs to be fixed. And under law, most contractors are given an opportunity to fix that defective work. So there are sort of parallels to what this bill is proposing and what we already have incorporated into the CCB claims program. The board has asked that we have a 30-day notice prior to filing a claim because we think that it would be it would save both the CCB and the parties money if they could resolve their dispute without the government getting involved. And this is even probably more money, represents more money being saved when you're looking at a court system as opposed to the CCB system. Most people go through the CCB claims process, at least up until the hearing process, without an attorney, and so they're not paying out a lot of money for this system. But once they get to a hearing, they're probably well advised to have an attorney. But in a court system, you usually once a complaint is filed, you pretty much are going to be required to hire an attorney and start spending some money.
Mr. Boyd, just to stop you for a minute, I believe you said you had 4,000 to 5,000 claims and about 400 hearings. So is that what you said about only about 10% of those go to hearing?
That's right, because we're able to resolve most of them outside of the hearings process. Some of those are because not all of them are settled. Some of them we issue an order, a proposed order, and if nobody asks for a hearing, then order becomes final. So it's just the same kind of order that the hearing officer would issue, but we get there without a hearing. The parties essentially accept the board's ruling. I also just want to add one other thing, and that's that it's been our experience that a fair number of claims, they get filed, and the first thing that we get from the contractor is a letter saying, you know, I never knew that there was this party never contacted me before filing the claim, I'm astonished that they wouldn't have at least, you know, picked up the phone and called me. We do get claims where, you know, the party picked up the phone and called a dozen times without any response, too. But we do get claims where the parties didn't call. And so this is sort of saying, look, before you go to get involved in the court system, or in our case, involved with the CCP claims process, we want you to have some contact with the contractor. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
One more question. Did you say in your testimony, or the previous testimony, that this is only available for the first year of construction? Is that true?
Yes, Representative Close. You must file your claim within a year of substantial completion or occupancy of the home, depending on whether it's a new or existing home.
So this bill would extend that type of process. Is that correct?
Your bill, the one that's before you today, actually exempts the CCB claims process completely. It doesn't affect the CCB claims process at all, because in the very last section of the bill, it excludes us.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gerard.
Question for Bob Repine. Under Oregon statute, which is referred to as 701, the definition of residence, does that include, and would this bill include, prefabricated homes on a fixed foundation?
Madam Chair, Representative, since I'm not party to the drafting of the bill, I don't know whether I have that answer for you. I'd defer that to Mr. Berry, possibly.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay. Representative Close, Representative Gerard, the prefabricated home is not included in that. The installation of that home is considered residential construction, but the portions of the home that are they're built by the manufacturer off-site are not considered residential construction, and so you would not be able to make a claim for that part under this definition.
Thank you. Interesting. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, I understand you said this bill doesn't affect your process, but how do you envision the process described in the bill interacting with the complaint process that you do have? Would they go on concurrently? Do you see this preceding somebody going to the CCB, or how would that work?
Representative Close, Representative Rosenbaum, this bill would affect any lawsuit that was going to be filed. If a party's out of time to file a CCB claim, their only other mechanism that's available to them is the court system. So in that case, we're out of the picture anyway. We do have claims that are filed where a party files it in court. Usually the party that files it in court is the contractor, and I don't think then this bill would come into play. But if for some reason a claimant decided that they would rather have their claim resolved by the court system, then I think this bill would kick in and they would have had to give in the notice that's required here. I don't know exactly. We may need to look a little bit to see in those situations if there's going to be any place where our system and this system clash, because they are kind of running parallel. They sort of are looking to the same thing. Our pre-hearing process is to get everybody out at the site and to look at the damages, and there's some elements of that here too.
Hey, follow up. I guess that really is what I'm getting at, though. I mean, we don't want to create confusion in the part of contractors or consumers that there are too many parallel processes and they don't understand which bureaucracy they're in at the moment. The goal of anybody wouldn't be to make a current state of affairs that's litigious more complicated from the standpoint of the homeowner or the person being doing the work.
Representative Close, Representative Rosenbaum, OBIA, who is one of the sponsors of this bill, has already contacted us and asked us to, when they sit down and write their amendments, to be at the table, and I think we'll probably be ironing out any problems with that. So.
Great. Senator Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Both in the previous testimony and in your testimony, there's anecdotal information about the rising insurance rates, and I would certainly appreciate having actual statistical information presented to the committee so that we have a sense of the problem. I've certainly heard of it more in the context of the development of condos and the development of larger complexes. of houses where lawyers are going shopping for suits, and they want a class action suit. They want to get dozens, if possible, of people together to file the suits at the same time. Really, I haven't heard of this problem in terms of the small contractor, and it'd be interesting to see statistics on how rates are going up for different classes so we can really understand where the problem lies, or whether it's much larger in some sections of the industry than others. So I'd appreciate it if between the insurance industry and your expertise in the department and yours with the Construction Contractors Board, we might be able to get some real data to understand the issue.
Representative Close, Representative Merkley, we will try to get you something. We did do a survey, I think it was about a year ago, about where we just sent out a survey to contractors and asked them what was going on, and so we may have some data for that, but I understand that the rates have continued to go up, and so we may not have anything that's terribly current, yeah, I mean, in the last 6 months or so, or but I will go ahead and talk to Craig, Craig Smith is our administrator, and see if we can get you some information to it, if we have it.
Thank you. The other question I have, Madam Chair, aren't there some other mechanisms that come into play to help protect the contractor, such as mandatory arbitration clauses and things of this nature? What role do those, in many industries, such clauses play this role of ensuring that there is a process before people go to court? Does that not operate in this industry, or what is the story there?
Representative Close, Representative Merkley, there are, to the extent that contractors have incorporated those provisions in their contracts, and we see more and more of them all the time, there are various clauses in contracts. Not only do we see clauses that require arbitration instead of a court filing, although this bill would also apply to an arbitration, but you also see clauses that require mediation prior to that arbitration.
But those are not sufficient remedies within the industry. They're not working for some reason.
I think that I haven't thought that through. One of the things I was told over and over again is never answer a question to the legislature that you're not sure you have the right answer for. I haven't considered that.
Well, I'll just pose that as a question worth following up on. Thank you.
Very wise, Mr. Boyd. I want to thank you for your testimony, and I also want to say that both of you do wonderful work for the state of Oregon, and we appreciate your involvement in this bill, and hope that you'll come back again. Thank you.
We will be back with that other bill.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the witnesses on this bill, and we'll look forward to seeing the amendments from the drafters. In closing the work session on House Bill 2389, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2391. And call forward, I'm going to call you as a panel, Kelly Page, Oregon Board of Investigators, Mark Halliday, attorney with Washington County, and Chuck Bennett with OBI. And committee, we also have testimony from Jeanette Pullman, Division of State Lands, but she's had to go to another hearing, so I think we'll be passing out that testimony. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Page. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Investigators. The board licenses and regulates private investigators.
Excuse me just a minute. Yeah. We did forget to do this summary, so we're going to do that first and then.
Okay.
My mistake.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2391 exempts air tracers from licensing requirements for investigators. And you also have a -1 amendment attached here that legislative council requested because they had made a mistake in the bill. They had an and where they should have had an or. So that is why we have a -1 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Close. The existing law that governs the Oregon Board of Investigators requires licensures of all persons who solicit or accept employment to obtain or furnish information about the whereabouts, associations, transactions of any person, or the location, disposition, or recovery of lost or stolen property. This bill exempts from licensure persons who obtain or furnish information about missing or unknown heirs. The board currently licenses many private investigators who specialize in asset recovery, computer searches, financial or asset investigations, missing persons locations, and public record searches. And these are the same activities that air tracers would use to locate missing or unknown heirs. We believe that air tracers clearly fall under the statutory definition of investigator, which is found in ORS 703.413. The board was established in 1997, and the existing exceptions to licensure were established then and have not been amended. The exceptions were designed to exempt from licensure those investigators who were otherwise licensed by the state or who were employees of one employer or government agencies. The board was established to protect consumers by providing standards and oversight of people who work independently as investigators. And passage of this bill would exempt from licensure a group of investigators who are not otherwise employed or licensed, and would also set a precedent for exempting simply a certain group of persons who otherwise meet the statutory definition of investigator. We believe that passage of this bill would adversely affect the board's mission, which is to protect the public welfare by ensuring that only qualified persons are licensed as investigators and that appropriate standards of competency and practice are established and enforced.
Questions? Yes, not. Please continue.
There is a fiscal impact to the agency. We believe the short-term cost to the board would be approximately $5,500 in lost licensing fees during the 03-05 biennium and $11,000 in lost licensing and renewal fees during the 05-07 biennium. However, these costs would be higher if other groups of investigators seek and obtain exemptions from licensure if this bill passes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And if you have any questions, you can contact me at the board office.
Okay. Mr. Halliday, I wanted to give you an opportunity. You're in support of the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Holliday. I'm an attorney up in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of my client, Mr. Maynard Nelson, formerly a resident of Oregon, currently residing in Vancouver. However, he continues to work in Oregon and has business interests in Oregon, and he is here in the committee room should the committee want to hear his testimony directly.
Excuse me, does he want to present his testimony?
He's ready and willing to present testimony.
Okay, it's a little unclear to me who... Between you and him, who would be the major presenter?
I believe I'd be the major presenter.
Okay. Madam Chair. Would you like to call him up with you?
Please.
Okay. We'll call Maynard Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank the committee for the opportunity to present testimony. One of the reasons why we're here is because this is a republic, representative republic, and we have an issue that we'd like to be addressed, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we absolutely positively have to have our way. I agree with Ms. Page that the purpose of the statute is to protect the public, and one of the reasons why I'm here is because I believe, based on anecdotal evidence, comments I've heard, that the original inclusion of air tracers or probate researchers was an oversight in the original sense of the word. And it turned out that such people were covered by the definition of the statute. And of course, it makes some sense because you do want to protect the public when you have people out contacting them to say, by the way, you may have some money coming. If you work with me, I'll get it for you. However, the clause that includes private investigators under ORS 703.4013C and E, recovering lost or stolen property or evidence to be used before a court, are the only two parts of that clause that describe activities performed by probate researchers. The other three sections do not apply, and those are the sections I believe that the public typically identifies with a private investigator when it thinks of someone doing that work. For example, probate researchers are not conducting surveillance. They don't make citizens' arrests. They don't go out and dig up current information on people. Probate research or air tracers work with the past. Everything they do relates to the past. The most immediate thing that they do is deal with someone's fairly recent death, but that is a fact that has occurred. It cannot be changed. Then they go back and work with a birth certificate. Again, a fact that can't be changed. And often they're working with grandparents and ancestral data. Or they're reviewing census data. All these records are publicly available. And the information that is used to start the search, whether an air tracer learns of a case at the Division of State Lands from the unclaimed property section, or if a probate researcher goes to a courthouse and learns of the assets, all those records are publicly available. And so it is an area where people can start out small. They can start out working on this part-time, and they can progress into a full-time career, as Mr. Nelson has, doing it, without otherwise having to spy on people, without having to worry about causing defamation or slander or paranoia among the public, because you're not looking into the present activities of a person. You're finding out when he or she was born. And, for example, there are other protections already built into the system. You cannot obtain a birth record. Actually, I believe private investigators can, but an air tracer who is not a private investigator cannot obtain a birth record unless the heir specifically asked them to, and they will usually have to be a legal representative, so they usually would have to hire an attorney or an attorney's office. Or a person can request their own. Death records are available after, I believe, 100 years. But those are rules that are established by the Vital Records Department. And this bill does not ask those rules to be changed because the probate researchers don't have an issue with those rules. So not only do you have other agencies already providing some protection to the public, but you also have, for example, the Division of State Lands, which if it's contacted by a party who believes that they have some funds coming due, has the opportunity to contact the air tracer, or if the air says, you know, we believe that there's a person operating here that is operating unfairly, the Division of State Lands can step in. Mr. Nelson has spoken with Marcella Easley over Division of State Lands, and I've established a close working relationship with Ms. Cheryl Gladden over at the Unclaimed Property Desk. And I will say I believe both of those ladies actually would like to have the private investigator licensure continue. But it has been a working relationship that has been congenial for a number of years with both of those people.
Can you tell me, Mark, what are the costs associated with becoming a private investigator? And I think I read here there's a test that you take.
There is a test you take. I believe there's a $40 application fee. Licensing fee is $550 per year, Madam Chair. So, every 2 years. And so the fiscal cost would be a loss of revenue of, in the next biennium, 10 private investigators. And according to Ms. Page, over the biennium after that, 20 private investigators. Excuse me.
Just to follow up, are you saying there's only 10 people such as these type of people in the state?
No, Madam Chair. I don't know how many there are. I've spoken with Mr. William Davis of a California firm, Brandenburger & Davis. He believes there are maybe a dozen larger firms in the United States. I believe the testimony that was handed out to you talks about the International Probate Research Association, and Mr. Nelson can address that better, but it was made up of 10 to 15 of the largest companies. People who had been in existence for a fair number of years, had established a national clientele, etc. The other reason why I believe the public welfare is being protected is because not only is an agency usually involved, but often a court is involved. The Division of State Lands requires, unless it's you personally prosecuting the case for money that you may have coming, that if it's on behalf of an estate, you obtain letters testamentary or a claimant successor's affidavit, and letters testamentary are going to be issued by a probate judge, and therefore you're going to have a formal proceeding, and before the money is ever distributed to the heir, a probate judge is going to have to sign off in the final accounting to verify that all the I's were dotted and T's were crossed. It gives an heir a lengthy time to present a claim if the heir has a claim, because even if the heir only presents a claim at the last stage, at the final accounting stage, there is still built in a 3-week delay before a judge can approve a submitted final accounting. And I know that we have seen cases, I've prosecuted cases, where we have come in at the last minute to distribute funds to the proper heirs by objecting to the final accounting.
Representative Gallegos.
Yes. Outside of being licensed as an investigator, what other licensing or regulatory anything to... Could anybody just paint an air tracer on a shingle, hang it up, and start that business?
Madam Chair and Representative Gallegos, yes, they could. The competition in the marketplace, I believe, is the enforcement mechanism there. For example, your cousin passes away, and I'll pick a nationally firm, known firm, American Research Bureau, comes in and solves one half or solves the entire family. And Mr. Nelson comes in and solves one half or solves the entire family. If the two charts offered to the court do not match up, either someone's wrong, both are wrong, or someone is lying, and you cannot continue in business offering faulty data, again, we have a idea that a court or an agency is providing some oversight, because you're not going to have otherwise licensure at the state level. Perhaps they have to obtain business licenses, but that doesn't guarantee any protection of the public welfare.
Paul, my cousin doesn't have any money, so I wouldn't care. I'm thinking more of, under the realm of mentions also of genealogists, there's significant interest for people to trace their family histories, and what credibility does an individual have that where there is no estate at stake, but tracing their family history and to know that the information they received is correct, it might be a very long time before anybody recognizes that the data that was ever provided them was valid, invalid, and someone has collected their check and is long gone.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, the air tracer industry typically receives fees for bringing assets to heirs and or to owners of those properties who don't realize that they have them coming. Most of the air tracer industry do not perform as a primary business genealogical research solely for genealogical purposes. And furthermore, I believe that people who conduct genealogical research solely for tracing the family line are, I believe they're exempt. Now, Ms. Page, I'm sure, can tell you better. As I recall, they're not required to be licensed if you're just trying to find out whether you're descended from someone who came over on the Mayflower.
Could we have that answered?
They aren't specific, Representative Gallegos, Madam Chair. They are not specifically exempted in our statute. However, genealogists who are maybe hobby genealogists aren't really in the business of accepting employment or charging money for a genealogical search, and they're really they are not collecting in most cases a fee for that,
but they could and call themselves an air tracer, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And not be licensed. Sorry, follow up.
If they're tracking the whereabouts of current heirs, that would fall under our statute. And if they're looking for lost property, that would fall under our statute. If they were simply trying to trace, the family tree going backwards, they probably would not fall under our statute.
I'd like to go to Chuck Bennett next and let you present.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Bennett. I'm the public member of the Oregon Board of Investigators. Just a couple of things I wanted to point to, particularly in the Division of State Lands testimony. where they discuss proving up as part of the process of and production of identification documents to prove an heir's rights to the estates. I think part of the, and I want to focus on the division just for a second, because I think that's one of the policy areas you all deal with anyway. Many of these, the money that is dealt with through estates in the division of state lands are arriving there. All of them arrive there without a known heir or a will. In the past year, there were 37 of these estates that were handled at the state level. The average value was $100,000. Now that starts at starts at zero, where there's actually bills owed. There is not a lot of, I can assure you, there's not a lot of tracing going on where there's bills owed, up to $1.2 million, of which, as the previous person mentioned, there is a percentage that arrives in the hands of the air tracer who finds the heir. This is done, these cases are often done on the air tracer's own motion. They go in and they look for the estate, they look at the value of the estate, and they go look for the heir. And you find the heirs out, and there's another bill, Senate Bill 64, which is trying to move the goalpost on who's an eligible heir to collect these funds, move it from cousins, I think, to another level of family, to a known relative. But what you find in this are really substantial amounts of money based on guaranteed identification, based on research that would fall under, in any way you read our statutory construct, would fall into the responsibility of the Oregon Board of Investigators. And as the division says, the only reliance they have on consumer protection or some sort of oversight is through the Board of Investigators, and they then conclude their testimony saying, if not the Board of Investigators, there is a need for oversight. So if you set up the Board of Air Tracers or some other board that relates with it, in some way, with the kind of money involved, the kind of proving that's involved, and the access to information relative to the heirs that's involved and the proof of identification, you're going to, in some way, have to put these people under some sort of oversight just to kind of prove up their bona fides as the state protecting consumers. So as the public member, we're certainly interested in retaining them, mainly just to provide that oversight, and then if you decide on another group, certainly turn it over to them and let them deal with it. I will assure you, though, that at the size of the Oregon Board of Investigators, we've hit just about as small as you can get in a state agency and still have enough money to provide any kind of guarantee to you that this is being done at a level that you would feel comfortable with in terms of meeting those obligations to the public and the public good. Thank you.
I'm going to hold questions and go to Mr. Nelson, give you the last word. You're not going to speak?
I don't know. Nothing to say.
Could I ask one question? What is your fee when you do these types of research? Do you take a percentage of what the person recovered?
Yeah, always. It ranges between 10 and 50%. Depends. Depends on where it starts. If you know there's going to be expenses, sometimes you're back-ended in a case, whereas you don't know what happens, but the money's gone when you come there. There's more expenses than you expected. There's situations where the state has, I don't usually work on the state items, but they'll say that there's so much money there, well, it's based on stock. You come to the end of the course, the stock has no value, or it's a fraction, 10% of what it was, so then you're in the hole. And then it doesn't cost anything to the heirs, because if there's no money, then I cover all the costs, so I take all that risk.
I see. Okay. All right, questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nelson, I looked over the statutes for what's required to register with the Board of Investigators, and I didn't see anything very onerous. I did see provisions designed to protect the public, and certainly I wouldn't want someone with a history of criminal involvement in fraud to be involved in helping to establish and qualify heirs. What is it that you've found that is so onerous about the current process that's motivated you to come
they're,
and...
They're not on point. They're not on point. It's kind of like an example would be if you're a company that braids hair, but you have to get a beautician's license to cut and color hair, it's not on point because anybody can braid hair. And also, I see your concerns about somebody that had fraud or whatever, but in a way it really doesn't matter because it always goes to the judge. You've got to have an attorney represent it in court, and it's going to go to the judge. And then also the Division of State Lands does a very, very good job of policing the money that's in their coffers. But everything else is all in front of a judge. It's got to be presented by an attorney because an attorney has to pray for the court to grant his motion. So it really doesn't matter. But then also the other side of that is a typical estate, you have a guy that's actually a, no slight here, but is a checker or a box boy at Safeway. All of a sudden his relative dies. He's never had $2,000 in his bank account. All of a sudden he's in charge of an estate worth $100,000. Well, he doesn't know how to handle the money. If you don't find those heirs fast, he is going to spend that money. So actually, the heirs, most of the time, are the ones that are kind of greedy. And there's and if they get caught, in a typical cousin's case, on the cousin's on the father's side, they go, look, at, I first maybe check on the case, and the attorney will say, because an attorney handles it already, and he represents the cousins. So he's kind of biased. And he goes, no, my clients have told me who are the heirs on the father's side. There is no other cousins. I can't say always. Most of the time, they lie. I've been doing this 20 years next month. Most of the time, they lie. And what happens if they get caught? And they want to split that pie of $100,000, let's say, three ways. They don't want to split it in a total of eight ways. If they get caught, all they say is, we didn't know. There's no downside. They get a chance to roll the dice for free. And if no air tracer shows up, me or another company, because the case is too small, too complicated, they get the money. And they never get caught. There's no downside.
Thank you.
Okay. We need to go on to the next bill. So thank you very much for your testimony. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
We will consider it carefully. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2394. And I'm going to open a public hearing. I'm going to open the public hearing on 2383 to take the testimony of one person who has to leave, and that's all we're going to allow on that bill. Welcome, Paul, and we're happy to accommodate you, and then we will be closing that hearing and then going to the next bill and bringing that one back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'll be very brief. For the record, Paul Cosgrove, and I'm representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, which is a member of the United Financial Lobby, and I appear on that behalf as well, and the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which has car financing subsidiaries. And our concern about HB 2383 relates to Section 2. You've heard a lot about this bill in the context of towers and other people who have possessory liens, but as written, this bill also applies to other people who have liens, i.e. security interests, all the lending institutions as well. So I don't probably need to go into the detail of why that concerns us, because I think you can imagine that the restrictions in Section 2 would be problematic for the credit unions and consumer finance companies and banks that have security interests in cars as well. I'm not sure that was the intended result of drafting it, but as it's drafted now, we are also lien claimants and therefore covered under these restrictions in Section 2. The provision in Section 3 on the bottom of page 2 makes it clear that it's only applying to possessory liens, and we don't have possessory liens, so that is not of concern to us. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Paul, are you working with the drafters of the bill to amend that section out? Is that
I've had a brief conversation with Monty King, and I will have another one. We talked mostly about the other bill that was heard on Monday, but we will have a discussion about this.
Okay.
Thanks
very
much.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2383 momentarily. We will intend to get back to that within 20 minutes. We're going to go to the next bill, which is House Bill 2438, open a public hearing, and call Aaron Thurber forward. Thank you. And the staff will read the summary.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2430 requires a person who solicits application for issuance of a credit card to communicate with the individual or individuals who sign that application. It also requires that the person who solicits the application for credit disability insurance of a credit card communicates with those who sign the application. And it requires the person who solicits the application for issuance of the credit card to offer credit disability to the individuals who sign the application. This bill also makes an offense of these things and puts it into the unlawful trade practice.
Welcome, Mr. Thurber.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Thurber and I live in Brooks. And I wish to speak in support of House Bill 2438. Standard procedure among credit card companies and their affiliated disability servers or carriers is to communicate with and offer disability insurance to only the primary application signer. This means that all the rest of the signers, no matter in what capacity or order they are, have no protection and will continue to be liable for any debt incurred on the account. This bill requires that telephone and other solicitors be willing to communicate with all signers of the application, giving all the chance to purchase disability coverage according to normal underwriting criterion. Not offering this opportunity to all signers, I consider a bad business practice. If a person doesn't meet the underwriting criterion, the company may refuse to cover him or may red him. Signers of applications are not forced by this bill to purchase disability coverage. They are given the choice. Credit card companies and insurers are squawking, saying it will increase the cost of disability insurance and credit. Perhaps this bill will encourage competition so that disability insurance costs will lower. And I might say that having more insureds should lower the cost of having the disability coverage as it spreads the risk among a greater number of insureds. Insurers are making large profits and they can afford a competition. Insurers should not complain as they're in the business of selling disability insurance, and this bill will help their sales. This bill does not interfere with any federal regulations regarding disclosure of the cost of credit and insurance. And I'd like to tell you a story about why I'm particularly interested in this. It's that my wife and I were solicited for a Visa credit card from Capital One, which is a major company. My wife was the first signer on the application when it came, and I was the second signer on the application. Sometime later, we were working in our yard and had a portable phone with us when a call comes from a telephone solicitor asking for my wife to solicit her for disability coverage. Well, my wife could not hear what the solicitor was saying, and she told him to please talk to me, making me her agent, because I handle insurance matters in my family, being a former insurance agent. Well, the solicitor totally refused to talk to me because I was not the primary signer on the application. And he indicated that that was the company policy of not to communicate with anybody but the primary signer. And thus my wife did not get any disability coverage, and later she became disabled about a year and a half later, and we were settled with a hefty debt that had to be paid. This bill will help some people avoid bankruptcy. Even a small debt can be significant and catastrophic to a person who becomes disabled and is on a fixed income, or on Social Security for that matter. I do hope that you will consider this bill and hopefully pass it. And I thank you for your time.
Questions? Thank you very much. Call forward Cheryl Pellegrini, Department of Justice.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection and Financial Fraud Division. The Department of Justice has concerns about this bill. While we do understand Mr. Thurber's plight and what he's trying to accomplish through the bill that's before the committee this morning, concerns that we have are twofold. Both involve the bill's purported inclusion of this measure in the State Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That brings up two issues. First, as it's currently drafted, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act specifically excludes insurance. So to the extent that this is an insurance matter, the legislature has made a policy decision that all matters of insurance are governed exclusively in this state by the insurance commissioner, which is housed in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Second concern we have is that it also relates to the extension of credit via the issuance of a credit card. We'll tell the legislature that there are two Oregon Court of Appeals cases. One is Lamb versus AmFac. It's a 1980 case. It's found at 44 Oregon Appeals 203. There's a more recent case from 1996, Cullen versus Investment Strategies. That's at 139 Oregon Appeals 119. These cases both look at the applicability of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to the extension of credit, both in a loan and a mortgage loan context. Both cases, when read together, make it clear that the Court of Appeals have opined that the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, as it is currently drafted, does not apply to the extension of credit unless it's the extension of credit made in close connection with the sale of a consumer good or service. And that's found in, that language is found in the Cullen case. While the Department of Justice has taken the position that extending the reach of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to cover the extension of credit would certainly provide substantial benefit to consumers, we also believe that that contemplates a policy discussion that has not yet occurred, at least in the context of the presentation of this bill to this committee. Those are our concerns. I have additional consumer concerns. I have a suggestion that if the committee is interested in perhaps moving this bill forward, it might consider amendments that it would place it within the insurance division's purview and to redraft it, or to ask legislative counsel to redraft it in that matter, because we also have concerns about it being characterized as a consumer protection measure at all.
Questions, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to thank Mr. Thurber. I always admire citizens who have a personal experience and who bring their concern and a proposed idea to address it to this body. And while I'm reserving judgment on whether this is the right solution, I really wholeheartedly applaud your effort to address a situation you found onerous. I would like to ask, Cheryl, this policy of speaking only to the primary signer, is that rooted in a form of consumer protection to make sure credit isn't extended, if you will, to the wrong party or someone imitating the primary signer? Or does it? What are the roots of the issue that we're addressing here today from a consumer point of view?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm a little out of my element in credit and insurance because it does fall outside of what we directly deal with. If I had to make an educated guess, I would guess that it's based on the fact that the contractual obligation is between the primary signer and the credit card issuer. But okay, that's just a guess.
Okay, thank you very much.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Cheryl. You made that much clearer for us. I appreciate your coming. Okay, there are no further witnesses to testify, so I'm going to close the public hearing on 2438. And we're going to open the hearing again on House Bill 2383, and call Monty King. And I believe you're the only one who signed up to testify on this bill at this point, other than Paul Cosgrove, who has testified.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Monty King, and Executive Director of Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. I have talked with several of the other interests about this bill, and I do have some amendments that are going to be requested, and those are to change my name off the bill, put Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association on it instead. To delete lines 10 through 12 on page 1, and I think I have a copy of the bill here, and that would take care of the lien claimants who foreclosed liens on motor vehicles must submit to the department the application for title on the vehicle. We do believe that the first part of taking the license plates off the vehicles would be sufficient for the purposes of what we're trying to do. The
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, Monty, I'm sorry. Does that Mr. Cosgrove just gave testimony a little bit ago, and he was talking about secondary liens being protected by removing 10 through 12. Does that address their issues? I mean, is the secondary, you know, if they're secondary third lien holders, are they protected by not submitting an application for title, or does Dean, where's that clearinghouse happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gallegos, I believe that takes care of their concerns about the bill, about having to submit for the title. As far as secondary and third, and I don't, maybe there's an attorney in the house, but I'm not one. The new language would basically be taken out, though, where the person who foreclosed a lien would have to submit the title. That was one of the two ideas, to try and make sure that these vehicles were title registered in the name of the person who actually bought them when they get back on the highway. But we believe that just taking the plates off will force the issue. So that's why we took out the second part of it. Mr. Chairman, on page 2 of the bill, after the new subsection 12, we'd like to add a person who offers for sale to a vehicle dealer who is a holder of a vehicle dealer certificate, either a new certificate or a renewal certificate, sold by the person to foreclose possessory liens. What this would do would add a second, another new exemption from dealer licensing. The new sub 12 would say anybody who took a vehicle by a lien, say a mechanic, then they could sell 5 per year under those circumstances. And then the new sub 13 would say those same people could sell unlimited amounts of vehicles to on a wholesale basis. So that goes even farther. So I believe that our association has moved significantly far to allow those people who foreclose on liens to be able to sell the vehicles they're taking in. It is our firm belief that once the public auction is held at the time and place designated by the person who forecloses the lien, that once that foreclosure sale is completed, whoever has the vehicle at that point now owns the vehicle. The lien process is complete. So I kind of believe, given that scenario of the timing of when the lien has been foreclosed and now it's a possession of somebody, I believe at this point there is no exemption from dealer licensing currently for those people. I believe that this would help all of us.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. King. If I understand what you're saying, then a person in the situation of foreclosing the lien would have two options. They could sell it at retail if they go through the normal process a citizen would sell a vehicle. or they could sell it essentially in a wholesale manner to a dealer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, the first five they could sell retail, and anything after that they would have to sell wholesale to a vehicle dealer. There are many tow operators who have dealer licenses. Mm-hmm. And just as an aside, I talked with the mechanic who fixed my son's car yesterday. And he does, it's Cliff from Cliff's Automotive. I asked him if I can use his name, and he said yes. And he said that is absolutely fine with he and people like him. It's more than enough for his purposes of a regular mechanic with a regular shop. He's not going to take more than that or deal with it more than that. We believe we've taken care of both the whole mechanical industry with this and the tow industry. But that's as far as we mm-hmm. have gone okay. to that point.
So first five retail can sell the rest to dealers, or they could get a dealer's license themselves and sell. Okay, thank you.
I have a question. Yesterday you passed around, Monday you passed around to the committee photos of tow companies that were selling vehicles. And as if this were a problem or that you were trying to address. Of those companies that you had taken pictures of, do you know if any of those tow companies hold licenses to sell currently?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do not believe they do. I have checked the records at DMV for those names of those tow companies, and I do not believe they do unless they are licensed under some other name, which is possible. I have checked those on the DMV website, which any consumer can do, by the way, if you know the name of the company.
So it's your assumption that at this point, from the research that you've done, that the tow truck companies that you submitted pictures to this committee on Monday do not have a dealer's license.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is true, particularly the South Salem towing sign that you saw that said cars for sale on the reader board. I did actually talk with the owner of that company, and they do not have one. By the way, that sign was removed by 12:30 Monday afternoon.
Okay.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Munchie, wanted to ask you.
I don't know
please.
How to do this.
I'm never going to get that gavel away from you. It was someone testified at our first hearing that if this requirement of removal of the plates were in effect, that if you were moving the vehicle simply from where it was towed to the auction, you'd be in violation of the law because you'd be moving a vehicle without plates. Is there a fix for that? I mean, what do you think about that?
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, I don't know exactly how to do the two chairperson thing, but
for the record, I am the chair.
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I am the only chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosen.
There are heart attacks all over the building right now, just so you know.
I think there are several fixes. You do not have to be, as far as I know, a dealer to be a DMV agent. And to issue trip permits. Trip permits right now are 21-day trip permits. They cost $20. You buy them in books of 20 at a time. There certainly is that process. Anybody who wanted to buy one of those could go down to the local DMV and get a trip permit for that vehicle. The other fix, of course, is these are tow operators. They got tow trucks. If somebody wants that vehicle towed someplace and put down someplace, they have the ability to do that in pretty fast order. The whole issue is, do you want the vehicles on the highway that are going to be continue to be driven by people without driver's licenses, records, insurance, all that type of thing?
Representative Gallegos.
We're seeing some disconnect out here on your answer with the DMV. Will Kelly Taylor be testifying at all? Maybe answer that put you coming in. Clarify that question about the DMV trip permits.
I would appreciate that too.
Kelly, would you be willing to come up and testify, please? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. You would not be eligible for a trip permit because in order to have a trip permit, you need to be registered owner of the car to get that 21-day trip permit. So I don't think that's an option. I'm not sure how the person's going to get the car from the auction to DMV legally after the plates have been removed. And I'm not sure that just removing lines 10 through 12. I mean, I understand what Monty's trying to get to. He's trying to help get the records updated and get transactions put through properly, and that's a good thing to do. But taking the plates off the car is the least fast way to make that happen. between lines 6 through 9 and 10 through 12, 10 through 12 actually is the more effective method of getting the records updated as to who owns the car, and doesn't make the problem of how do you then move the car occur. I mean, getting the application into us, getting the records updated fast, that is the better of the two options, frankly. Because just taking plates off the car, if these people are truly the scourges of the world, they're just going to go steal plates off somebody else's car. It still doesn't help anything. Getting the application to us, getting our records updated, issuing a title in that person's name, that is the way to start tracking who owns the car. And then they don't need to worry about a trip permit. They don't need to worry about how to do the other stuff.
Anybody else have a question? I'll let you. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Chair. As a sponsor of this bill, my concern was protecting the consumer and the idea of a license plate of which I still may be the registered owner of a vehicle out of my control is what I was concerned about with this bill.
Right.
In that as long as that license plate is not under my control, but it is my liability, that's what concerns me from the standpoint of the consumer. And that's my main concern.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, I totally understand. And if I could back up to some discussion that was done on Monday when you were all discussing that seller notice form 6890, that is on the back of all registration forms because that is typically what the owner has in the position. They may or may not have a title. A title may be in the hands of the security interest holder, the bank or somebody. But you do have your registration card that's supposed to be in your glove box. And on the back of that is seller notice. And we have added seller notice to our web page. So you can protect yourself from that liability by filling out the form on the web page. And then we will flag that record that you sold it. That is what the seller notice law was done in 95, was specifically for that. So that if you sold the car, you had a way of telling DMV, I have sold it. Now, Kelly may not have put the title in her name yet, but I sold it to Kelly. And that is supposed to help reduce the civil liability you would have for parking tickets and accidents and things like that.
Follow up. When is my liability ended? When DMV receives that certificate? When I mail it? When I fill it out? When it's processed? Where along the line?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, I'm not an attorney, but my understanding is your liability ends when you sign that title off. And if you were to keep a copy of that title, a Xerox of it or something, or the bill of sale, you would have from that moment, you gave it to me. Now, the way you then tell us about it, the faster you tell us, the faster we mark the records. But even if you don't do a seller notice to us, which is required under the law within 10 days for everybody, and we've tried to get the word out, like I said, it's on the back of the registration form. Even if you don't, there are ways for you to prove yourself innocent by canceled checks, things like that, showing that you've sold the car. That's what people have done for years, even before seller notice, was had to get their paperwork trail together to show the tow company or to show the parking ticket officer, or, you know, the court or whoever was after them for whatever, that they had gotten rid of the car. So it actually is when you sign that bill of sale or that title, you're saying, I walk away.
I'll follow up and then Representative Kitts has a question.
If I'm in an accident and my car is totaled and it's in a towing yard or a wrecking yard, who did I sell the vehicle to?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, if you, well, you haven't sold it to anyone at that point. Now, it may be that between you and the insurance company, they're going to pay you for it, in which case they're going to take the title and turn it into a salvage title and you know, show that it's been paid as a total loss. You may still own it. Until you sell it to, you settle up with your insurance company, you still will own it.
Okay.
Follow?
So, if I have a vehicle that can't be driven, but the plates are taken off that and put on another car. During this process, am I not still liable for wherever those plates are?
Mr. Chair and Representative Guard, no, because you have to give permission for those plates to be moved off your car. We don't just, the person, wherever those plates are registered, whatever car that's registered to, that registered owner has to tell us to move those plates. They don't just get to show up on another car. Not legally. Now, if somebody steals them, that's a whole other matter. But
okay.
But your liability doesn't follow the plate. It follows the registration of the car.
Representative Kitts and then Representative Merkley.
Kelly, thank you. And the issue is becoming not confusing, but what it's appearing... what's appearing to me right now is that Mr. King is trying to address a problem that we all agree is a problem. But what's appearing to me is that what he's asking that happen, the action to take place to address the problem, is not going to solve the problem according to what you're saying. That's my first part. So would you agree with that? Because obviously you're saying that the best way to track this and make sure that what we don't want to happen doesn't happen is to keep lines 10 through 12, which Mr. King is proposing to delete.
Madam Chair and Representative Kitts, I don't know where the gavel went, but I'm assuming that's where it went.
Back to her. Breathe easy, everyone.
You've been dethroned.
If the goal is to get these cars registered to the person who owns them as quickly as possible, then between those two methods, take plates off or turn title application in, title application is the faster way to do it. Because title application submitted to us means the records get updated. Taking plates off a car will maybe eventually force someone to a DMV office to make application, or we'll have somebody taking plates off of somebody else's car and driving around until somebody detects that they've been taken off the car and that they really don't belong to that car. Right. What I'm saying is if the goal is to update the records, 10 through 12 is submitting an application to us, making those records change. That's the direct bingo there.
Follow up?
Briefly, I know there's two questions to follow me. Off of Representative Girard's statement, if I bought a truck, a car, and mailed in, and the person signs the title over to me, and at that point I send in the title to apply for the new title in my name, in that process, for example, I haven't received my title back yet. This person signed off on it, but I haven't received the new title and registration. Who's my truck licensed to right now?
Madam Chair and Representative Kitts, technically on the record, it's still I still own it. Let's say I sold you the truck, and I give you the bill of sale.
Okay.
And because I don't have my title and you know, or whatever, I give you the title, I give you the bill of sale, and you fill out the paperwork and you send it into DMV. Until that paperwork is processed by DMV, you still look like, or I still look like the registered owner.
And I have 30 days to do. I'm sorry to interrupt. And I have 30 days to do that. Is that
right? And I have 10 days to turn in the seller notice.
What happens if the car is wrecked in that time? I guess that's where my question is. Where's the liability?
And Madam Chair, Representative Kitt, that has been gone on forever. I mean, that's not going to change because until you have instantaneous title transfers, and I don't think we'll ever get there.
Okay.
It's always going to be between you and me to show the paperwork. I'm going to show that I took in money or that I have a canceled check or whatever and that I sold it to you. You're going to have your canceled check. It's always going to be between us, and it's been that way forever.
Okay.
Representative Merkley and then Gallegos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. By the way, Madam Chair, I want you to know you really did a good deed today. You made Representative Kitts not just his day, but probably his week, his year. Really, really enjoyed that opportunity.
Well, I'm not sure what you're talking about, but we're happy you enjoyed it. Review the tape.
By handing over the gavel for a short period.
I really wanted to see you have a chance to gamble.
That makes two of us, and she came back.
As we go through this process, the person who owns the car and is concerned about the plates on it and the plates still being on it, why not simply require the lien holder, when they foreclose, they're now the owner, why not require them to at least notify DMV or Department of Transportation that they have foreclosed the lien and the owner of that car, previous owner of that car, is no longer the owner? That way the consumer is taken care of. The consumer may not know exactly when that lien forecloses, and certainly isn't engaged in whether the car is driven with those plates off to auction and so forth. Why not simply, at the point that the lien holder becomes the owner through foreclosure, why not have them notify the Department of Transportation that the previous owner, his car is now theirs. It's now the tow company's car.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Merkley, that may or may not be a feasible method. I mean, it's adding an extra layer in there of notification, whereas if the lien holder could just as easily turn in the title application, which is what's proposed in lines 10 through 12, which until the title application comes in, it still doesn't change the record. That's why seller notice was created back in 95, so that the seller could take a proactive stance to protect themselves. And although they have 10 days, they could do it day one, and now we've put it online, so they can do it fairly instantly to us. Okay. So that was help the consumer.
Okay,
and then
follow up here in this case.
Representative Merkley, we need to get to Gallegos because we don't have much time. Can you make a quick one?
I'll follow up with you.
Okay.
Thanks.
So my question has to do with, really, if someone were to remove the plates, then the presumption is if you really just wanted the plates, you'd go steal them, drive around without insurance till you get caught. But I don't see much difference. I mean, there's no crime committed by buying a car with the plates, still not insuring it, drive around. I mean, the risk is still there to people, you know, the public, by having someone who's purchasing the car with the intent, again, not to get insured. There's no mechanism or forcing function to make anybody go register the car.
Madam Chair,
end up in the same place.
Madam Chair and Representative Gallegos, I've been with the department a lot of years, 25 this May, and I have come to the conclusion that there's a certain number of people that no matter what you ever do, will they buy insurance or will they follow the laws? That you're right there. Getting the application of title in is title and registration. It's true. Someone on any form that they fill out may lie about their insurance coverage. They may say, I've got Safeco and my number's blah, 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 blah. That's what's on the application. That comes into us. By getting the application and title in, you have done at least one thing that isn't happening by just taking plates off. And that is, you've now recorded that Kelly Taylor owns it, and this is her address. Now, that doesn't mean that Kelly Taylor truly has insurance. Taking the plates off doesn't mean that Kelly Taylor has insurance, but taking the plates off doesn't even make the record show that Kelly Taylor now owns it. And so by getting the paperwork in, that's at least you've noted if it's in a hit and run and somebody got the plate number, at least they'd know who the last owner was, and it probably is more up to date than if you just take the plates off. The other thing I just want to say real quick, Madam Chair, because I know this came up before about insurance. Having the plate with tags on it, the stickers, may make it look valid, but they're not riding on your insurance. I want you to know that, because there was a law passed several years ago. We are electronically hooked up to insurance companies. And as they sell insurance and cancel insurance, they update our records. And the records they update are the vehicle records. So when an officer runs a plate number, ABC123, it will tell them who's the registered owner, the last registered owner, and whether or not insurance is on file with that car. It'll say insurance on file or insurance not on file. And you've actually made it part of the law that is probable cause to pull over that car and check further. So, yes, I may buy an old car that has good plates on it, but your insurance, because one of the things you will do when you sell a car, even if you forget seller notice, is I'll bet you're not still paying that insurance premium. I'll bet you called your insurance agent and told them, cancel me on that insurance. I don't want to pay that anymore. And that insurance agent company will then notify us that ABC 123 that Kelly sold has no insurance.
Okay, I want to give Mr. King the last final remarks on this, and we will continue working on the bill. Bring it back.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, there are some issues with 6890. Perhaps DOJ can answer and probably should. But the issue here is not whether the insurance is on it or whatever. It's that there isn't any requirement for the person who gets a vehicle when it was abandoned. The people who are abandoning their vehicle are not going to fill out a 6890. Now, this is not just 10 or 20. It's 50,000, 70,000, 80,000 of these. That's the issue here. That now that vehicle is in somebody's possession who doesn't have to tell the state they have it, and they can sell the vehicle without telling the state they sold it to who. Now, the industry, probably the other parts of the industry, we're okay with it, but the other parts of the industry doesn't like the subsection 2 of section 3. Because that makes them do a lot of paperwork, a lot more paperwork than just taking off the plate. You know, the plate's taken off it. Then the new person who buys it, however, is going to have to pay a new registration, which is going to bring more money into the state for roads and bridges. Why should the person buying that vehicle that's cost the public agencies a huge amount of money, getting it off the streets, be able to now take that $30 registration and use it for their own purposes for the next year and a half, year, or whatever?
Madam Chair.
Same kids.
Procedurally, since we're not going to, I don't want to cut you off, Monty, but I would ask the chair that we ask Monty to come back because we're not going to be able to ask questions of this testimony that he's giving now, and I'm already starting to have questions on what he's...
Okay.
So would it be possible to have him come back and if that's okay with you, to testify so when, you know, during the committee when it's scheduled, that we can follow up with questions on his testimony?
Is that agreeable to you, Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, that is great with me, except for Friday. I have to go down and do a dealer education class in Medford on Friday, so...
Well, I guess next week we will schedule it again, and we can have the Kelly and Monty came back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We appreciate it. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2383, and if there's nothing else for the good of the committee, we are adjourned.
Well, so